The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
This is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. So, last night, it did not go great. I guess you could say that did not go great for the Democrats. And, you know, when you've been doing this as long as I have, you kind of, you get used to how you, discuss these kind of election nights. And, this one wasn't great. There's no question about that. I mean, let's just review the basics. Terry McAuliffe was defeated by Glenn Youngkin in Virginia. Seems like the actual margin is going to be pretty close, probably under 2-point margin, which is, for what it's worth, pretty close to exactly where the final polls had it, 1 or 2 point race. So substantial swing from the Northam victory in 2017, and also substantial swing from Joe Biden's victory in 2020 in the state, which were of comparable margins, around 10 points, something like that. So you have like a 12 point swing. And then we still don't have a result in New Jersey, but it seems like Governor Murphy will probably pull it out by a very, very, very thin margin. Now, that race was, I think, in the final polls, you know, a 10-point margin for the Democrats. So it seems like, you know, win is a win, but we can see, you know, a similar tide, a similar kind of story for the evening. And then you have down ballot races, which show basically a similar picture, although, you know, not in every case. Republicans did really well in Long Island, in New York State. Democratic Socialist Democratic nominee for the mayoralty in Buffalo lost. That's India Walton. She lost to the incumbent mayor, who ran a write-in, campaign. Now, that to me is part of a very different narrative. That's basically an intra-democratic thing. But you know, I did a post on this morning. I did one on McAuliffe's defeat last night. It's really hard to run a write-in campaign. You know, we say all of these things, you know, so much of the voting rights, voter suppression discussion is the various ways that you can kind of make it harder on the margins for people to vote, right? It's really hard to vote if your candidate's name is not even on the ballot, and you have to remember like, oh, okay, the option I want isn't even an option, but I'm going to take out my pen and write in the person's name. That is really, really hard to do. And yet it seems like the incumbent mayor, Byron Brown, is probably winning by like 60-40. And this is one of those campaigns that there's a lot of sort of sour intra-democratic mojo. But if you lose by that margin to a write-in candidate, the voters just didn't want you to win. There's no, you know, I see stuff about, you know, the establishment, you know, kind of ganged up against her and stuff. Well, I think the voters really ganged up against her. So that's another thing that happened. We have a new mayor in Boston. We have a new mayor in New York City. Those were both pretty much expected. But again, those are the things, that's urban America. which is basically Democratic stomping grounds. And the big take, my big take, at least from last night, is, and I wrote this in a post late yesterday evening, we shouldn't be surprised. You know, the question is kind of, you know, how did this happen? We think of Virginia as a fairly blue state. Democrat lost. You know, Democrats had a you know, they won the presidency in 2020. They didn't do fantastic down ballot or in congressional races. They actually lost ground in the House. In any case, to me, this one is pretty simple. The president's not popular. The president's popularity has fallen dramatically over the last 4 or 5 months. Now, when and so you have that. You also have the fact that right now, if you are not tightly bound to one of the two political parties, I think what you see is that the president keeps saying it is important to pass a couple bills that make up his presidential agenda, and he's unable to get it done. And two senators who most Americans had never even heard of before have the president kind of running around in circles. And we keep having votes that don't happen and more negotiations and setbacks and blah, 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 blah. What you really see is the president looks weak. If you say something is important, then you should do it. And if you can't, you seem ineffectual. You seem weak. And I don't say any of this as someone who's not a fan of Joe Biden. I'm not down on Joe Biden, but this is just the reality. He's not popular and he looks weak. And then you add two other things into the equation. Again, things we've discussed, which is that the national mood about the economy is not good. People do not think the economy is good. Now, there's a lot of statistics you can point to say, well, you know, there's a lot of job growth and there's growth and blah, 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 blah. But that is not the popular perception. And some of that, I think a lot of that is there's various consumer commodity goods that are expensive now. You try to order things, they're backed up. You know, stuff we've talked about, supply chain, you know, inflation, price of gas is high, stuff like this. And then the big one is we thought COVID was going to be done. President Biden ran on saying he would bring the pandemic to an end. And the pandemic is not over. And what's worse is that we had several months where we really thought we were putting it behind us, and then we weren't. And now we're in this period where, you know, the numbers are, you know, we're doing better than we were a few months ago. We're certainly doing better than we were last winter. But we're still in the pandemic. You know, we're still wearing masks. We're still, still trying to get people to get inoculated. Still a fair amount of, you know, large numbers of people dying. Some places you can eat indoors, other places you can't. We're still in the pandemic. And so what I think we see is that people thought we were going to be in a much better situation now than we are. And when you add to that the fact that the president looks weak because he can't seem to get his bills passed, and there's talking and talking and talking and talking and talking, people put those two things together. We're not done with COVID and the economy sucks because the president's hapless. President's weak. He's not a strong leader. You put those things all together and Democrats lose elections. That is one of the most basic things about politics. And what I think you see saw in Virginia last night, probably saw in New Jersey, is that this spectacle for the last several months on Capitol Hill, talking, about to have a vote. It doesn't happen. We think that we're going to have an agreement. The agreement doesn't happen. Now, you know, yeah, it's the sausage making and all that kind of stuff. But there's no question that has demoralized partisan Democrats. If you think this stuff is important and you're like, what the fuck? Did we elect Joe Manchin president? Did we elect Kyrsten Sinema president? What's going on here? So you demoralize your own supporters. And then for people who aren't supporters, they just see, like, in, for a lot of the electorate, and this is always something that's really important for those of us who kind of live and breathe politics to remember, what they are keyed in on is less the specific stuff the president is trying to do than whether he can do it. Because if you are part of a company or part of an organization or part of anything, you want someone in charge who can get things done. Obviously, it matters what they get done, but that's a big thing. And none of those things are looking good right now. So again, you have a situation like that. Members of the president's party are going to lose elections. That is not a surprise. And if we didn't know that, we got a pretty good example of that last night. One thing I will say that I think is an important benchmark setting for understanding this. It's not like Democrats always win elections in Virginia. It's not a blue state. It's a swing state with a strong Democratic advantage. If you go back 20 years, back to, 1999, every time the winner of the governorship is of the opposite party to the incumbent president, with one exception. And ironically, that one exception was in 2013 when Terry McAuliffe won after Barack Obama won re-election. But these off-year elections, again, this is also a bit of a pattern. Incumbent president's parties feeling they got it all done. They're not as hungry. The opposition's really hungry. So that's a pattern too, and we shouldn't forget that. And that's also kind of a pattern in New Jersey, actually. Not quite the same pattern, but if Murphy wins, I believe he will be the first Democratic governor to win re-election in New Jersey in something like 40 years. So there are other patterns here that are, that point to this kind of being what happens when one party's in power, and this is the sort of the first bite at the apple that the opposition gets. So we got a lot of stuff to talk about, and we'll talk about one thing. We'll talk about is okay. We just talked about how the consequences of the sort of the dithering on Capitol Hill for the last 4 or 5 months. We have more dithering to look forward to, and if past is prologue, you're going to have a lot of those kind of moderate types saying, "Oh, the people have spoken. Maybe we shouldn't do this reconciliation thing." Now, I will remind you on that very unpleasant night. I guess a dozen years ago, when Scott Brown, I think is his name, the guy who won the special election for Teddy Kennedy's Senate seat and took away the Democratic supermajority that they were using to pass Obamacare. And, it was in December. I don't even remember exactly, but it was roughly the same time in the political cycle, right? And it seemed at first okay, there goes Obamacare, right? Because it was in a similar stage to where this reconciliation mumbo jumbo is now, kind of back and forth between Senate and House and blah, blah, kind of seemingly right near the finish line. And that night, Barney Frank, not Joe Manchin, not a Joe Manchin type, right? Barney Frank, I think at the time, was he then the dean of the Massachusetts delegation? I can't remember exactly. One of the big liberals in Congress. He puts out a statement and says, "Well, I guess Obamacare is done. The people have spoken. And it would be wrong to pass it now." And I remember thinking, like, dude, are you on crack? Like, what is going on? Like, are you kidding? Like this one election and suddenly you're like, oh, okay, I guess we just have to, the people have spoken. And I mean, yes, the people have spoken for one seat, but like, you're going to give up? People get very wobbly very quick. So we're going to talk about that. And before we do, let me remind you that the Josh Marshall Podcast is brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. You got hooked on $6 iced oat lattes and $5 nitro cold brews. It happens to the best of us. But a few months and a few $100 later, you're ready to become your own barista. Making cold brew at home isn't rocket science, but it is messy. Not to mention the need for grinders, strainers, unitasker brewing containers. If you want to make cold brew at home the easy way, order a Grady's Cold Brew Kit. It's a simple and space-efficient way to make a week's worth of coffee without the mess. Ready to give it a swirl? Get 25% off at Grady'sColdBrew.com with promo code TPM. That's Grady'sColdBrew.com with promo code TPM. Okay, co-host Kate Riga. What is going on? I've gotten everybody pumped with my monologue. So what do you have to share with us?
Well, so the thing that I've been interested in is that pundits have basically been telegraphing how they were going to treat this race for weeks, if not months. This was going to be, if McAuliffe lost, the big bellwether. Democrats are doomed 2022, 2024, probably forever. You know, this is it. It's over. If he wins, we're never going to hear about it again. I mean, in that way, it's like the Gavin Newsom re-election all over again. It was how many pieces did we read about kind of because of one outlier poll? Newsom's going to lose in freaking California, Democrats. Like, get ready. And then Dianne Feinstein's going to die. And then you're going to lose your Senate majority. And that's what you have waiting for you. Then, of course, he won handily, and we didn't hear about it again. It's just so funny how those two things are treated. You know, I mean, it is a black day for Democrats right now, like wall to wall gnashing of teeth, rending of garments. And as you say, McAuliffe, I don't think anyone saying that last night was good for Democrats, but, you know, like you say, there was a piece on MSNBC today about listing that in the first year of the presidencies of George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump, their parties lost the governor's mansions in both Virginia and New Jersey. So, you know, just putting that out there to maybe stem the tide of this is the most cataclysmic electoral result we've ever seen ever in the history of any party, because it's not that. Again, bad for Democrats, for sure. But I'm saying there is like a lot of historical precedents that would kind of point to what we saw last night. And as you said in your monologue, Josh, things aren't going great. You know, the pandemic is omnipresent and Congress is just meshed in this agonizing gridlock. But the thing that I keep coming up against is just getting away from maybe what the McAuliffe campaign should or should not have done, which we can talk about. We can talk about Glenn Youngkin's kind of dressing up of this white grievance. But I don't know what Biden / every congressional Democrat who's not Manchin or Sinema could have done to change this. You know, like, there's this kind of debate on Twitter right now where you've got people like Tim Kaine saying, I was saying for months we should have passed these two earlier. It would have helped McAuliffe. And then people saying, well, a lot of the stuff in this bill wouldn't have even kicked in until XYZ. Would that really have helped? Is McAuliffe that connected to Congress? I kind of land in the middle of that where I think you need an appearance of forward momentum and competency, and that helps Democrats writ large, which hasn't been happening. But the reason it hasn't been happening is because Manchin refused to at all even debate reconciliation until October 1st, per that weird memo he signed with Schumer. And then ever since he has been debating, he pretty much ends every miffed press conference he gives with, we need to slow down and look at what's in this, and says ridiculous things about, we need to measure the inflationary impact, which, as Representative Yarmuth said yesterday, is just stupid. You can't do that. We never do that. There's no means of doing that, you know, or he's quibbling about other things like work requirements for paid leave. How can you leave a job that you don't have? It makes no sense. But anyway, the reason why things have been going so agonizingly slow boils down to one or two people. And there's no obvious answer for me in how you change that situation, or how they could have changed that situation before last night.
Yeah. And I, that is right. I mean, one thing you said, I mean, this is the thing, a lot of, in some ways, this is something that is particular to policy-oriented Democrats. This idea like, well, if you would have passed these bills in the spring, they still wouldn't have kicked in. Well, the people who say that are really dumb. I mean, God bless them. And I'm sure they're very smart about the things they're smart about. But Democrats are uniquely liable to policy literalism. Most people are not. I mean, you know, one of the things we've seen is that only like half of the people who actually got like checks even know they got them.
Mm-hmm.
Or who passed them. Or, you know, people are not like policy analysts. But people do. What does come through is the president winning or not winning? Is he getting stuff done? And that is something that comes through. And again, for a significant part of the electorate, they are less focused on the specifics of the president or the you know, the party in power's agenda as whether they're able to execute on it. This is obvious. This is the real world. And so, look, it's not like let's create an alternative reality where both of these bills passed in April, right? Does that mean that the president would be at 57% popularity and the Democrats would have swept this? No, I don't think it means that. You still have where COVID is. You still have the economy in this very weird place. You know, you look at certain statistics and it's doing fairly well. But, you know, do people, if gas prices are high or the price you pay for basic foodstuffs is high, everybody sees that. You know, unless you are super, super rich and you don't buy your own food or kind of you're indifferent to the prices, you see that. That's not good. And there's just, it's a very dislocated economy right now. And people have lost jobs. Maybe they're gaining jobs. You know, there was an interesting, statistic out. There's several sort of benchmark studies that come out once a month that look at popular, you know, what people think about the economy. And some of these are government statistics or, you know, kind of quasi-government statistics. Others are private, but they're kind of seen as benchmarks. And one of these showed that, something like 70% of people said, hey, great time to be looking for work, right? Lots of jobs available. And a roughly similar number of people said, economy's in bad shape. Well, that doesn't seem to line up, right? I mean, if it's a great time to be looking for a job, that sounds like the economy's doing well. But it's a very dislocated period, and conventional numbers, I think, mean even less than they normally do. But you put these two things together, and it's not a good thing. Look, another thing, another reason it's important to do these things early is that they're done. If you know that is what you know, I'll tell you. When and I've written about this on the site at some length, that I think the public reaction, the press reaction to the withdrawal from Afghanistan was really off. Was far more negative than it should have been, but it did start pulling down the president's numbers. And when I saw that, I think I wrote a post about this. You better get that bill passed soon. Unpopular presidents do not get things passed. So there are, you add to this is that this all looks really, really similar to what happened in 2009 and 2010. You know, really similar, really similar. Down to, you know, you had the healthcare town halls. Now it's, feral Trumpers showing up at school board meetings. It's really, really similar. Again, people who people who are really policy focused tend to be fairly dumb about politics. This is just a reality. You can quote me on that. So let's shift gears, Kate, to what have we seen so far this morning up on the Hill as you know, in reaction to what happened last night?
Most people are basically trying to take what happened and say this is further proof that we need to pass these things now. We need to pass them as quickly as possible. We need to notch this win. We need people to start finding out what's in the bills, because that's a huge problem. And I think there's broad recognition that so much about these elections last night were out of Democrats' control. I mean, to a certain extent, there's not that much they can do about the pandemic. I mean, obviously there is, and they are, you know, they're doing it. They're getting vaccines approved for children and booster shots and all that. But the reality that there is a sizable swath of the country that will not get vaccinated and is predicating their political identity on that fact, that's not going to go away. And there's not much Democrats can do about that. The resulting economic turmoil, I mean, that kind of goes hand in hand with the pandemic to some extent. I think the sadness and the anger and the trauma we as a country have experienced from this once in a generation pandemic, something everyone's trying to deal with. But I think there's recognition that they've got all three chambers for what feels like, you know, an even more tenuous amount of time right now. And they've got to pass the bills. But again, it goes back to this point that you're right. People didn't elect Joe Manchin president, but every single senator has veto power, and he's the only one who's yielding it ruthlessly and constantly. So it doesn't really matter when, you know, I hear from, you know, Dick Durbin and Tim Kaine and all these people like, well, this should really light a fire under our ass to get this done. Great. You know, for 48 senators, that fire's been lit. If Manchin and Sinema were normal Democrats, these bills would have been passed already. So it's just like, the question isn't, do Democrats kind of need a nudge to get this done? It's, will this at all change the calculus for Manchin? Will he let it go forth? And then there's the huge looming threat that it will inspire him to do exactly the opposite, that it'll give him some kind of, you know, this is a rejection of Democrats, I need to hastily tap dance away from the party, and then throws up more blocks to the reconciliation bill, basically robbing Democrats of like one of their only weapons they can use to fight a lot of, you know, a lot of headwinds, like the political precedent of what they're heading into in 2022, Biden's numbers, and these other kind of intractable features of society right now that are impossible or very hard to tackle or to figure out how to tackle.
Yeah, I mean, one, you know, another issue with passing these things is, again, I think it shows you can succeed at what you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And again, that is an asset, even for people who are indifferent or even not crazy about what it is you're doing, right? The ability to move forward is a big thing. But an equally big thing is, the Democrats need to stop talking about this. And when I say this, I don't mean stop talking about, you know, if whatever ends up being in there, which even I don't know, which is a kind of a bad sign since I do this for a living, right? But the negotiation, they need to stop talking about Manchin, stop talking about Sinema, stop talking about this back and forth and all, you know, all of this intra-party squabbling is toxic for the party. But in addition to that, they need to move on from it, because it's true. Look, I don't blame Joe Biden for the fact that there was a Delta variant. I mean, it's a virus, right? I mean, it kind of, this is fate at some level. But one thing I do notice is that, yes, they're getting CDC and FDA approval for vaccines. And, you know, he goes out and says, every so often, like, oh, you should get vaccinated. But I'll tell you this, I haven't seen Joe Biden talking about ending the pandemic in months. Now, I'm sure if I said this to someone at the White House, they would, I'm sure that, you know, there's well, there was this time he said this and he made this press appearance and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, I get it. The president says all sorts of things. But again, I'm pretty suffused in politics, and that is not what I've been hearing. What I've been hearing is about the Build Back Better bill. And what I've been hearing about it is less what's in it than the endless fighting over it. So for Democrats to have a hope of having a better result in 2022 than they had last night, a few things need to happen. One is the economy needs to get into a more stabilized place. And there are things that the president can do about that, but that is obviously not something that the president totally controls. We need to make progress on COVID. That's kind of, you know, sort of the same thing. It is certainly not not something that is entirely in the president's hands, but they need that to be their focus. And right now, it is not their focus. Their focus is getting this bill passed. And what, you know, people, Democrats roll out these polls like, well, you know, the Build Back Better thing, it's super popular, and this part's popular, and that part's popular. And yeah, those things are popular. But for, unless you're a partisan Democrat, this is not what you're really focused on. What you're focused on is the present economy and COVID. And really COVID, because the present economy is both perceived as and in reality an outgrowth of the COVID pandemic. And that's what people are focused on. And they need to actually be focusing on that and be perceived to be focusing on that. And neither of those are happening right now. I'm not saying they're ignoring the pandemic, but this is their focus, and it is dragging down their popularity. And so for them to have a better result, they need to pass some stuff that is going to give their own partisans a sense that they've gotten some victories and done some big stuff, i.e. pass these bills and hopefully other bills, but at least these bills. They need to get some luck, right? They need things to start moving in a more positive direction, and they need to appear that they're on the case. And the one thing that you can do to speed all of those things along is pass this thing. There is nothing the president or his party can do to start moving things in a better direction until these two bills pass. You're going to be stuck right here. There's going to be no progress. No progress in a political sense, let alone a policy sense. They cannot turn the page until these things get passed. And like, you know, Joe Manchin saying, oh, let's take a few more months. Well, okay. Wait until February to see if you can start changing things. There's not a lot of time left.
It's just a massive problem that I just don't see. I don't see a solution for, because Manchin has proved unmovable by outside forces. Like, I don't think he cares about what happened yesterday. He's kind of proven that he doesn't really care about the electoral fates of, you know, his colleagues who are up in 2022. He's shown us again and again, he wakes up in the morning, you know, he puts a finger to the wind, sees which way the kind of belt, the gusts are blowing, and decides, you know, this is how I position myself to be a centrist and to care about bipartisanship. I'm going to be the number one biggest obstacle to everything that Democrats want to do, including the popular stuff. You know, he gave a press conference on Monday that he previewed and said, everyone's got to decide where they stand. We're going to come out and talk about it. And it was ridiculous. I mean, it was huffy. He was pissed off about something. He probably read something he didn't like. But it was, the whole thing was just to remind people, I could vote this down at any second. And I'm totally comfortable in doing that. That's what this whole presentation was. And I think you could kind of tell based on the reactions to it. You know, the White House basically was like, yeah, we think he's going to vote for it anyway. You know, various senators were kind of like, nah, nothing new. I think he was just pissed off. Like, it was, you know, we're basically having to view this like dressed up temper tantrum because the one senator that matters like was pissy about something. And then we come away not knowing anything new. And that's just how it is. And then the progress is made in these agonizing stretches. Like, they actually had a fairly big win yesterday when Schumer announced that they'd come to an agreement on a proposal to let Medicare negotiate down costs of prescription drugs, which is, I mean, it's a big deal. That's something a lot of Democratic presidents have tried to do and have been thwarted by the fact that the pharmaceutical lobby has incredibly deep pockets and, you know, a lot of influence. And in this case, that was something that it looked like Kyrsten Sinema murdered weeks ago. Looked like it was dead. She says she didn't want to do it. What are you going to do? And they did manage to kind of wrangle it back from the dead. And it's definitely scaled back and less ambitious than what they wanted to do. But it's there. It's going to be in there. It's got all 50 votes. That's a big deal. That's a hard thing to do. And it just doesn't even matter because it gets subsumed into the next chapter of the psychodrama of what Manchin cares about and what he understands and doesn't and what he wants to do. And now you have, you know, this Blue Dogs coalition in the House led by Josh Gottheimer putting out this like pouty statement where they're like, we want a full CBO score and we want 72 hours to read the dang bill, as if they're going to read the bill. And it's just kind of like,
now, what didn't they, but weren't, you know, Gottheimer's whole thing has been the SALT deductions. Yep. And moving that back to where it was before the Trump tax cuts. And just mm-hmm. to remind everybody, this is, you can deduct state income tax against your federal taxes, which frankly, I think is good policy. And I think it's good policy just on general principles, but it also supports high tax, high service state governments. But that's been their big thing. And I think he put out a press release just like yesterday or something saying, yeah, yahoo, we got the SALT thing done, full speed ahead. Now, that's in the reconciliation bill. So I don't understand. Is he going to like vote against the reconciliation bill? I mean, that's his whole thing.
Well, that's the thing that makes no sense about it. It's like waiting for a CBO score. I mean, lawmakers are estimating that's going to take 10 days to 2 weeks for, you know, since you have text. And right now we only even have House text. We don't have text that's gone through the Senate. And those things might be a bit different because the House.
Now, I thought Brian Schatz said that you need the CBO score as part of the reconciliation process itself.
Right. Right. So there will be a score at some point. Basically, they're just trying to, because you have to see how it affects the budget as it's going through the reconciliation process.
Right. So basically, to the extent that you're waiting for a CBO score, that has to happen on the Senate side, right?
Right. As the process is moving, as they're doing all this other stuff, they have to do the privilege scrub and double check everything by the parliamentarian and stuff. But
right.
they're basically asking for like a CBO score separate from that, which would basically just add in like two weeks.
How is it separate from that?
For a CBO score before the House votes on the reconciliation bill, which might happen as soon as this week. So that's before the Senate process gets going. And as Steny Hoyer responded to it, he's like, well, you know, most parts of it already have been scored by various kind of entities, but there are still, you know, there are pieces that are still being negotiated. So that
is separate, though, from, because what I was thinking about was Joe Manchin saying, you know, I lose track of when he said what, but at some point in the last few days, he added that he wants to see a CBO score. Now, but that is the Senate part of the equation, right? So that part is, he was not, him demanding that did not really change the calendar for the Senate side. Now we're talking about these House types also saying they want a CBO score of the House thing and before the House votes. Okay, so now I understand what you're, so kind of two. Now, I thought there's a few of these coalitions in the Democratic House caucus. There's the New Democrat Coalition. Mm-hmm. There's the Blue Dog Coalition. I think the New Democrat one is a little more in line with party. I mean, they're both kind of, you know, centrist groups, but I think that the New Democrat coalition's a little more like close to the leadership and the rest of the caucus. Is that basic? Because I thought I saw them putting out a statement last couple of days saying, you know, yep, full speed ahead. We're, you know, all good. Let's move. But this is the Blue Dogs. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the separate sort of bespoke Gottheimer group, right? That
which has a bit of overlap with this group,
with the Blue Dogs. So it's mostly the Blue Dogs, but a sort of, like I said, sort of like a bespoke, you know, like doing a, he's doing a collab, which as is, my sons would say,
right?
With, with the Blue
which
Dogs.
Is funny because, as you say, it's like if he's getting his will on the salt tax thing, and the most recent news I saw on that front is that progressives were basically going to allow it, but they're kind of fighting over an income cap to who this applies to, because there's some concern, you know, Bernie Sanders keeps saying, I don't want to give a tax break to millionaires kind of thing. And there is a truth that the salt tax, you know, helps wealthier people.
Because they pay more income tax. Right.
But it seems like they're going to get the salt thing in there. The details are being ironed out. So it's like, as you say, that was Gottheimer's big sticking point. Gottheimer's other big sticking point is, as he's been shouting from the rooftops, he's so desperate to get the bipartisan infrastructure bill passed, which, as House progressives keep saying, okay, great, happy to pass it. We're not going to do it until reconciliation is passing too. So you would think that the natural next step would be, sweet, let's expedite these things, let's get them done, you know, to fill all of Gottheimer's wildest dreams. But I think he is just looking at what Manchin's doing, and Manchin's like, well, let's slow it down. So he's like, yep, centrist position, let's slow it down, even though it runs directly counter to his own kind of priorities in the legislation.
A funny thing is, and history is pretty consistent on this, what really always happens is that it is the, you know, it's the centrist types who get slaughtered in a wave election, which is the sort of the backdrop to this whole conversation. If the Democrats have a bad election, lose control of both houses of Congress, you know, it's not the, you know, Brian Schatz's and Maxine Waters's and, you know, AOC's who are going to lose their seats. It's the Josh Gottheimer types. And it is now, and, you know, one of the things, I think it was, I can't remember who said this recently, but there's this idea in Washington that these, you know, centrist people in kind of, you know, kind of swing districts, that these people have the pulse of swing voters. And in practice, now, someone like Joe Manchin is kind of in a unique case, right? He's not in a slings. I mean, he's in a very conservative state. He kind of knows he has known how to make it work to date. But most of these people, they don't really have any particular insight into anything. They come in on the waves and they get swept out on the waves, and they really have no special insight at all. But again, it's always those people who end up getting slaughtered when you have a bad election cycle. And I get why, with like Gottheimer, I get why he wants to get that that transportation bill passed. I mean, I want to get it passed, right? But it's always been a little weird with him, because he's not going to have a separate fate from the Democratic Party. And none of his group is going to have a separate fate. They're all going to have a common fate. And so this, you know, this stringing it out stuff, they are going to pay the biggest price for it. But everybody's going to pay a price because the Democrats aren't going to have their majorities anymore.
Yeah. Okay, let's turn to some questions. The first is from Scott, who asks if we can go over the Senate schedule, you know, when they're taking off for Thanksgiving, when does the debt ceiling come up again? What are we looking at if we have to wait yet another 2 weeks? So this is related to Schumer saying that he wants to start debate on the reconciliation text on November 15th. Today, we're recording on November 3rd. Next week, the Senate is out all week for recess. So they'll be back that 1 week, and then they're out again the next week for Thanksgiving.
So what does that mean? So what does that mean in terms of, if they do, like, let's say that Joe Manchin lets them start on November 15th. Do they have time to pass it before the next recess, which I guess is the Thanksgiving recess?
I honestly have no idea. I mean, there's going to be the privilege stuff, the Voterama stuff, the parliamentarian stuff. I mean, I assume that there is some degree of like walking and chewing gum at the same time here. But yeah, it's not clear to me. But I mean, we are entering like the holiday season, and there is one of the strongest forces in Washington is people wanting to leave. So, I mean, that's what I was talking to Kane the other day, and he was saying, I feel pretty confident we'll get these both done before Thanksgiving because nobody's going to want to stick around that next week and get it done. And that can do kind of incredible work in getting people to drop opposition or any kind of like slowing down of the process that they can do. But that also entails, you know, the House is planning to pass these two things this week, the infrastructure and the reconciliation text that they have, even though that text will go over to the Senate, you know, be tweaked and then come over back to the House. But the problem there is, you know, the House progressives who have been loath to give up their leverage on the bipartisan bill to vote for it, because then this fate of the reconciliation bill becomes much more uncertain. And they've kind of softened their stance recently. Jayapal said, if Biden tells them that he's got the 50 Senate votes on reconciliation, that'll be good enough. They'll let it go. If they have text and that promise, that'll be enough. Which aside, I mean, we've been talking a lot about Biden's problems, which are legion, but I don't think anyone really expected going into this term that the Congressional Progressive Caucus and Joe Biden would be as cozy as they are, as mutually respected as they are. I mean, there is like quite a bond between him and this group, which I don't know. That's something that surprised me. I don't think that's something everyone would have bet on as Biden came in.
It's certainly surprising from the vantage point of the spring of 2020.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. When he kind of zipped ahead of Bernie Sanders at that point. But okay. So the basic point is that it sounds like if the Senate Democrats can agree to actually start debating this on November 15th, there is a narrow window to have the big work done by Thanksgiving. And then I guess maybe there's like one final
post-recess.
No, what is it? God, I'm losing track of what is the it's been so long since there's like regular order in Congress. There I'm spacing on the word. There's the process when you have the Senate passes their conference committee. When you have two similar but not identical bills passed through the House and Senate, you have a conference where they get together and kind of do a little final thing, get a unified bill, and then both pass it again. So possible that you get the big thing done in mid-late November and then kind of put a bow on it, I guess, at the beginning of December.
Right. And as Scott mentioned there, December 3rd is like the next looming date when the debt ceiling comes up again. We'd have to deal with government shutdown stuff. We have the additional pressure now of the budgetary stuff is coming up, the appropriations bills. And there's already been a meeting with, you know, what they kind of call the four corners, the Democrats and Republicans on the Senate and House committees meeting on the appropriations committees. They came out of that meeting with like nothing decided except a pretty strong conviction that there's going to be a bunch of CRs, continuing resolutions, which will just set up kind of mini cliffs throughout the year as Congress is wont to do. So all that stuff is going to come to a head in December before Congress jets off for the holidays. So, you know, I think that's also another pressure kind of being like, God, let's get these two bills done first.
Right.
And then deal with the next stuff.
Got it. Okay. What's the next question?
Question from Steve, who says, something I don't understand is why Biden doesn't go after cinema and attempt to divide and conquer. Manchin has the credible threat of switching parties and is more popular in his state than Biden is, so he's got leverage. That's not the case with cinema. Why isn't Biden barnstorming Arizona to bring more pressure to her? And this is something I'm kind of eager to talk about just because the cinema problem has become so much smaller than it was in previous episodes.
It is. I was going to ask you about this. It is kind of weird that she seems to have dropped out of the obstacle game. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's exactly is that she's, you know, in earlier iterations of this, she seemed to kind of wait until Manchin was sort of running out of steam before she jumped in. I think my main answer to that question is it doesn't do you much good if you're a president at like 42% public approval to be showing up in someone's state. She's not popular, but he's not popular either. Now, among Democrats, she's much more unpopular than he is, but you know, you don't, it's not a very productive fight if you like, you know, like, oh, you're more unpopular than I am, you know, that doesn't work. So, you know, part of the answer right now is what's the point? He's going to show up and overawe her with his popularity? No, not really, because he's not popular. And if I haven't seen any polls of Biden out of Arizona, but I mean, obviously that is only barely a purple state. So if President Biden is, you know, at 42 or 43% nationally, he's probably a couple points lower in Arizona. So that's one answer. The other is, you know, modern presidents don't necessarily have all the juice that people think they do. And that has not been Joe Biden's, the way he rolls, right? It's much more, we're going to get together and talk. And that's basically it. That's the answer.
Yeah. On the cinema becoming less of a problem thing, it's just kind of fascinating to me. It's like she created this enormous problem by saying we can't raise taxes on corporations or the wealthy. I mean, enormous problem. Like that was going to be the primary revenue stream to pay for the package. And she took the whole thing off the table. And not only was it important, it was kind of like a no-brainer. I mean, if there's a litmus test in the Democratic Party right now, raising taxes on the wealthy and corporations is kind of it. So she did that. She made the Medicare drug negotiations. I mean, she initially took that off the table, which again is a thing that has a ton of consistent bipartisan popularity. The only reason it keeps not getting done is because the pharmaceutical lobby is so powerful. So she kind of takes her stances against these two super powerful things. And then she, I guess, lets herself be negotiated on the Medicare pricing thing. That's going to be in the bill now, a smaller version, but she allowed herself to be moved, which is kind of more than Manchin has done on basically any of the things that he's raised, with the exception of adding work requirements to the child tax credit. And then she agreed to the minimum corporate tax, which was also kind of interesting to me because it's just like not a ton of ideological consistency between those positions. And yeah, that's kind of where we're at. I mean, with all the stuff that's left, she isn't, at least in public, she isn't the big problem. I mean, we actually, that's the other weird thing about this. There just aren't that many loose programmatic ends left that they're still fighting over. I mean, you have the House kind of taking a stance on paid leave, but it's kind of more messaging than anything else at this point. Manchin has proven himself to be kind of unmovable on it. The Medicare pricing thing was like the big loose end negotiation thing that they were figuring out. Now we kind of have, we have SALT kind of, and they're still fighting over immigration with the parliamentarian, but I mean, they're on plan C by this point. So that seems to kind of be a fading effort. So it's just interesting. I mean, cinema went from being like a much larger and less explainable problem than Manchin to now we're back with just Manchin kind of slow walking the whole thing.
Yeah. I guess, you know, it seems to me that we can't rule out the possibility that basically she's just, you know, it's sort of like when you have like, you know, multi-person wrestling, you know, one taps out, the other, you know, the other guy's kind of gotten his energy back and goes in. But I wonder if it is, and I wonder if it has gotten through to her at some level that she's in a lot of trouble in 2024. partly because she is just roundly hated by Democrats. That's a big problem if you're a Democrat. And the overall political climate is not looking great. So I wonder if some of her drawing back is that she has, you know, sort of is rethinking her own political, you know, position at some level. I mean, that is, you know, I have no idea whether that's really the case, that that's very, very speculative. And it could, you know, entirely be that she's just, as I said, kind of given the stage to Manchin for a bit. But it has been a mystery to me for a while. I mean, it's been clear that she's in a lot of trouble for reelection. And she just doesn't seem to have recognized that, or to some people seems like she doesn't seem to care. I don't think that's it. I think she cares a lot. I don't think she has any intention of being a one-term senator. But who knows? Maybe that has kicked in a bit.
Yeah. Okay. Our last question is basically the same version of that question, but for Manchin. This is from Dan, who's asking, where can leverage be applied? He references, why isn't the administration using its executive powers to investigate his companies or that of his daughter, who has made millions overcharging everyone for EpiPens? Find out what Manchin loves and kill it, or threaten to, until he gets on board. And I feel like Manchin is so temperamental in this very like toddlerish way. I mean, even when he gets like criticism online, he holds a whole freaking press conference to basically flex his muscles and be like, hey, I'm king around here, you know, watch what you say. If the administration pulled out the big guns like this against him or his family, I think he would waste no time in being like, guess what? I'm a Republican now. Or guess what? I'm going to vote all this stuff down. Like, he puts kind of his own whims and moods above any kind of cogent strategy or ideology.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, first of all, look, we do not want presidents using the investigatory powers of the presidency to bully legislators into giving their votes. That's what we're fighting, not what we're doing. Now, I'm all for political hardball, but that is not, in my mind, that is not legitimate political hardball. And for what it's worth, I think that Manchin would go to war over it. I do not see that being successful. In addition to, I do not see that being right. And again, I am all for, you know, playing real political hardball. The way you play real political hardball is you say, hey, you know what? Yeah, it'll hurt us too, but none of the party committees are going to support you in 2024. Or, you know, there's lots of things you can do. The problem is that I don't think, you know, Manchin basically gets elected on his own in that state. Now, having said all that, you know, I believe Manchin was elected in 2012 and 2018. It's not like he's been elected senator 100 times, right? But the abiding thing here, the reality that has shaped this entire year, which has not been great, is that the Democrats do not have a lot of leverage on this guy. And I have thought about various ways they could have approached this differently. But the idea that there were sort of big guns that they weren't bringing out that they had, I think is basically wrong. They've got someone here who is really part of that, you know, kind of Beltway lobbyist scene, someone who is temperamental and kind of full of himself, and they absolutely need his vote. And that's a tough combination. There's no obvious answer there that Democrats are not availing themselves of.
Yeah, like I keep hearing jokes about, you know, why don't they just create like the Joe Manchin National Airport that is, you know, uses hoverboards and whatever. But it's, I mean, look at his attitude towards the reconciliation package. Like, he's killed proposals that would help his constituents more than they would help the constituents of other people who are pushing for them, because he happens to represent a relatively very poor state. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't make a dent. You know, he has this kind of vague, amorphous, like everything else he believes, idea of an entitlement society, and is absolutely dead set against anything that falls into that category for him, even when the kind of objective evidence is your state would heavily benefit from this proposal. It doesn't make a dent. So, I mean, the sticks would piss him off. The carrots don't move him. What do you do? What do you do with a guy like that? You just have to kind of apply whatever pressure you think you can and get down on your knees and pray that he comes around ultimately. And that's where we are. And that's kind of where we've been for months.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard for me not to think that there were much better ways to go about this. And it's hard for me not to think that the president and his advisors in the White House gave way a little too quickly in the meetings they had in the immediate aftermath of the passage of the rescue package. Because, you know, Senator Brian Schatz was with us in a briefing a few months back. And as he characterized it, a number of not just Manchin and Sinema, mainly them, but probably Tester and Warren, you know, probably a few other people, not saying the stuff we're at now, but saying like, hey, the COVID relief thing, that was an emergency. A, it was an emergency, and B, absolutely critical to give the president a win right off the bat. But we're not doing that on the infrastructure thing. We want to try to build bipartisan consensus. Just letting you know now, we're not doing that kind of rapid thing again. Now, I kind of think they being the White House, accepted that too easily. That they needed to kind of say, you know what? Time is our enemy. We need to move really fast. You give us your bottom line. You tell us, and we're going to move ahead. Now, having said that, though, this is the same Joe Manchin that seems immovable now, like 8 months later. So I want to say that. I want to think that. But that doesn't mean it was doable. So we really do come back to some situations do not have easy or good solutions. They may not have any solutions, and that sucks. But that may be the reality. So on that happy note, let me remind you that the Josh Marshall Podcast is brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. You can get 25% off at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. And that's it.
That's it.
All
right. See you next week.
Later.
The Josh Marshall Podcast is hosted by me, TPM reporter Kate Riga, and TPM founder, editor-in-chief Josh Marshall. The show is produced by Jackie Wilhelm. Thanks to Why Not Jansfeld for our podcast theme song, and thanks to all our TPM members who make this possible. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and subscribe wherever you listen.